But if you discover anything we can't, I may find it in my heart to be impressed. I'll hold you to that. You know, I never saw Brokeback Mountain. Gay cowboys. So I heard. On that subject, you see, Angel, you pass on my best wishes. And Louie? Tell him to take a Xanax. Walsh drove away. The dark was deepening, and the next flash of lightning arced like fingers of energy over land and sea, as though to pluck ships from the ocean, and the living and dead alike from their rest. This time, though, Parker heard it. The rumble of thunder. The approaching storm. He raised his collar against the rain and willed the squall to seek some more distant landing. Chapter 27. Quail must have slept, because when he opened his eyes, the tones of the room had altered, and the shadows were not as they had been. The pale child was standing on the patterned rug by the end of the bed. It was naked and sexless, its chest flat, and its head entirely bald, lending it a resemblance to an overgrown, unfinished doll. The pale child's joints were bent backward at the knee, like the hind legs of a horse, and its elbows were bent forward, as though the three points of articulation had once been broken and deliberately reset in a state of extreme dislocation. The nails on its fingers and toes were yellow and twisted, and neither iris nor pupil was visible in the whiteness of its eyes. Instead, a hollow remained at the center of each, so that if one were offered an appropriate angle and a sufficiency of illumination, an examination of the interior of its skull might have been possible. Quail did not stir from his chair. He regarded the pale child as one might a moth that had flitted into one's room, a presence without any intrinsic novelty in and of itself, but a distraction nonetheless. The pale child opened and closed its mouth, and its head bobbed in a pecking motion. Now, to Quail, it seemed more like a featherless bird, a fledgling fallen from its nest and seeking succor from one who had none to offer. A soft knocking came on the door connecting Quail's room to its neighbor. "Come in," he said. The door opened, and Pallet Amores was revealed. Like the pale child, Moores was naked, although Moores's proportions were entirely those of an adult woman. Her body was extraordinarily white, its mortuary expanse broken only by the faint tracery of veins revealed by the lamplight, like distant rivers cutting through snow, and the hairs at her pubis, the mirror into which these tributaries might feed. A small circular gouge mark, previously concealed by white makeup, was now visible on her right cheek. The mark was recent and deep, a souvenir of the failed attempt to dispose of one of Dobie's waitresses, but did not appear infected. Moores could not see the pale child. Her nature was not like Quail's, but she had grown adept at sensing the presence of the chthonic, the seeping of pollutants from one reality into another. She paused on the border between their rooms, as though reluctant to risk an incursion into unknown realms.
"What is it?"
she asked. And Quail was struck by the coarseness of her voice, a detuned instrument capable only of communicating the mundane and the ugly. "A child. Or something like a child." His eyes flicked to Moore's. "But it's gone now. You must have scared it away." If any insult was intended, Moores chose to ignore it, or perhaps failed to recognize it entirely. Even after all their years together, the workings of her mind were often alien to Quail. One might as well have tried to understand the thoughts of a spider or wasp, a predatory, hungry organism.
"I'll return to my room if you'd prefer,"
she said. "No, you can stay." She walked to his bed, climbed beneath the sheets, and watched as Quail removed his clothing. His body was without reserves of fat, an assemblage of muscle, sinew, and bone that resembled less a living being than an anatomical illustration, like some creation of Vesalius or Albinus, given only the thinnest of epidermal cloaks for concealment. He came to her then, and she shivered at his touch, for he was so very cold. When he entered her, it was as though she were being penetrated by a shard of ice. And as she held him to her, she thought that her skin must surely adhere to his, so profound was his algor. And when they separated, sections of her dermal layer would remain fixed to his, leaving her to lie with redness exposed. As he came inside her, she felt his seed spread with an anesthetic chill, proceeding beyond the chasm of her sex into her belly and her chest, her arms and her legs, until finally it found the red glow of her consciousness and dulled it to yellow, then white, then... Quail removed himself from her and reclined against his pillow. Mors was already breathing deeply beside him, although the stink of her exhalations went unnoticed by him. Quail had long since lost his senses of taste and smell, and ate only for sustenance, not pleasure, just as he took little sexual gratification from any congress with Mors. It was her warmth he desired, her energy in those moments permeating the ice and permafrost of his being to connect with whatever residual heat might yet reside in the tephra of the self. Coldness was the curse for living so long, if such prolonged agony could even be termed a life. Quail turned his head and looked to the corner of the room nearest the window, where the shadows were deepest. From them stepped the pale child, which had been present for all that had transpired, sucking in the sight of Congress through the recesses of its sockets. It sniffed at the air of the room and its musky residue of sex. "When all is done," said Quail, "and this world is altered, you can have her. You and your kind can have them all." Chapter 28. The storm swept along the coast during the night and woke Parker by rattling the slates on his roof and testing the security of his windows and doors, like a formless entity seeking passage to new territories. When he rose the next morning, his yard was littered with broken branches, and an old bird's nest lay strangely intact on his lawn. But the day was the warmest yet, and only occasional pockets of dirty white remained in the lee of trees. Parker wiped down one of the chairs on his porch and breakfasted on cereal and coffee with his feet on the rail, the call of birdsong for his listening pleasure. He felt the urge to speak with Sam, his daughter, but he knew she would be preparing for school, and he did not wish to interrupt her routine. He and Rachel, Sam's mother, were now in a state of uneasy truce. Rachel had suspended legal proceedings intended to leave Parker with only supervised access to his child, a consequence of his vocation and the violent proclivities of those with whom it brought him into contact. The disorder of his own life had bled into his daughter's existence, to the legitimate concern of her mother, and Rachel had believed herself to be left with no choice but to seek protection for Sam from the courts. Then, almost as suddenly as the issue had arisen, it subsided again, with Rachel unwilling to offer any excuse for her change of heart. Parker was content to let sleeping dogs lie. It was enough to enjoy time with Sam without another adult intruding, to be there for her without precondition or regulation when she needed him, even if the depths of his daughter's nature remained as mysterious to him as the remotest of ocean chasms. He sometimes woke to Sam's voice speaking to him in the night, as clearly as though she were standing beside him in the room. On those occasions, he would wonder if, in missing her daily physical presence in his life, he might be creating imaginary discourses in his sleep as recompense for her absence. But sometimes when he was awake, he heard her in conversation with another child. Their words carried to him as an echo from Vermont. And Parker had no doubts about the identity of the second figure, because he had heard Sam speak her name in the past.
Jennifer.
Sam and Jennifer, the living daughter speaking to the dead. The world could grow no more curious, Parker felt, even as he found solace in the knowledge that in time he would close his eyes in this world and open them in another, and there Jennifer would be waiting for him, and she would lead him to her God. It was 7:30 in the morning. Parker washed his cup and bowl, got in his car, and drove to St. Maximilian Kolb, where he arrived just in time for the start of morning mass. He took a seat at the back of the church, where he always felt most comfortable. He was not a regular attendee, but his childhood Catholicism had never left him, and he still derived comfort from a place of worship. On this spring morning, he allowed the liturgy to wash over him, the familiarity of its calls and responses itself a form of meditation, and he prayed for his children, the living and the dead, for his wife now gone from him, for Rachel, whom he still loved, and for the anonymous woman in the woods, and the child to whom she had given birth at the end of her life, that alive or dead, they might both be at peace. Daniel Weaver heard the toy phone ringing just as he was leaving the house. On an ordinary day, he would already have been at kindergarten, but he had a dental appointment on this particular morning, and so had been permitted to sleep a little later than usual. His grandfather was waiting for him by the front door, as his mother couldn't afford to take time off work. Daniel had sensed a certain new tension between his mother and grandfather since the latter's recent return, although he was unable to ascribe any particular cause to it. This fractiousness did not trouble him greatly, because his mother and grandfather often needled each other, mostly in an unserious way, but occasionally in a more grievous manner that might cause them to be at odds for days on end.
"Your grandfather is a stubborn man," his mother would offer by way of explanation,
which Daniel found funny, because with only two words changed, it was exactly what his grandfather said about Daniel's mother. Daniel loved them both, though a dad would have been nice.
"He went away, and then he died,"
was all his mother would ever tell Daniel about his father.
"Did he know about me?" "No." "Why?" "Because he left before anyone was even aware that you were growing inside me." "What was he like?" "He was like you." "Is that why you and I look so different?" "Yes, I guess it is."
Now here was Daniel's grandfather instead, big and strong, with his long prematurely white hair, tattoos on his arms, pictures and words, Daniel's name among them, and a piercing in his left ear. He wore faded denim jeans, big steel-toed boots, and a black coat that hung to the middle of his thighs. Nobody else's grandfather looked like Grandpa Owen. Daniel liked that about him. Grandpa Owen was cooler than any other grandpa. Cooler even than most kids' fathers.
"You ready to go, Scout?" said Grandpa Owen.
"Yes."
"That tooth hurt much?"
"A bit."
"Want me to take it out for you? Save you a trip to the Sawbones?"
"No."
"You sure? Only requires a piece of string. I tie one end to the tooth, the other to my rig, and bang! It'll all be over before you know it. And without an injection, either."
"I don't think so."
"Your choice. I'd do it for $10.
"No."
"How about we split it? 5 for you, 5 for me."
"No."
"Eh, you're no fun. Say, is that a telephone I hear?"
"It's a toy one."
"Why's it ringing?" Daniel shrugged.
"Dunno."
"Want to answer it before we leave?"
Grandpa Owen was joking, but Daniel didn't take it that way. No, he most certainly did not want to answer it. He wanted the telephone to stop ringing. The lady named Karis was growing more insistent with every call. She kept asking Daniel to come find her. She wanted him to join her in the woods, but he didn't want to go. Karis frightened him. Daniel didn't have the vocabulary to explain why exactly, but he thought the closest word he could come up with was hungry. Karis was hungry. Not for food, but for something else. Company, maybe. Him.
If it's broken, you ought to get rid of it, said Grandpa Owen. You don't want it waking you in the night.
I want to get rid of it,
Daniel thought.
I'd really like that, but I'm scared. I'm afraid that if I throw it away, Karis will come to find out why I'm not answering. She'll come, and I'll see her face. She'll take me into the forest, and no one will ever be able to find me.
Chapter 29 Parker left the church at the final blessing, trailed by the rest of a congregation consisting mostly of those older than himself. He hadn't managed to bring the average age down by much, just enough to make a statistical difference. He decided not to go straight home, but instead headed to the parking lot at Ferry Beach, where he left his car and walked on the sand, enjoying the solitude and the sound of breaking waves. He found himself returning to something Louie had said, about how the apartment seemed smaller, not larger, with Angel in the hospital. It might have appeared counterintuitive, but Parker thought he understood what Louie meant. Loneliness could cause walls to close in. That was certainly true. But the absence of a loved one brought with it a sense of greater restriction, of possibilities denied. Parker had lost two women under very different circumstances. The first, Susan, to blood and rage, and the second, Rachel, to the disintegration of their relationship. In the aftermath of each severing, he became aware of conversations he could no longer have, of questions that were answered by ghost cadences. Some words can only be spoken to those for whom we feel passionately and deeply, just as some silences can only be shared by lovers. It was one of the elements that made the thought of starting again so hard. That which was most missed could only come with time. And he had more days behind him than ahead. Man, he really needed to get another dog. Parker returned to his car, mentally arranging his current caseload in order of importance. A couple of matters required his ongoing attention, but they were mostly minor. It was the so-called woman in the woods and the whereabouts of her child that intrigued him. He planned to travel to Piscataquis and view the area of woodland in which the body had been discovered. He could always make a call to Walsh and ask him to smooth the way, or see if he could skate by on charm alone once he arrived. After all, a man could hope. He wanted to examine the site, not because he imagined he might spot something that the police had missed, but because it was necessary for his own process of engagement with the case, a delicate balance of distance and immersion. As he neared home, he saw a truck parked by the entrance to his property. It was a Chevy Silverado, but a few years older than the one to which Louie had put paid, and as far as Parker could tell, apparently unadorned by flags of the Confederacy. Parker turned into his driveway, and moments later the truck followed, maintaining a respectful distance, but still leaving Parker uneasy about its presence and annoyed at the intrusion upon his property. He wasn't armed, finding no good reason for carrying on his way to church. And despite Louis's advice to the contrary, he no longer kept a gun in his vehicle. If the car was stolen and the gun was stored in the glove compartment, then a court could find him in violation of firearm statutes. And if he kept it in a locked box in the trunk, it wouldn't be much use to him if he needed it in a hurry. He checked his rearview mirror. He could see only one figure. The driver, an older man, in the cab of the truck. The bed was uncovered and empty. Parker pulled up by the house and waited. The truck came to a halt while it was still some distance away. The driver got out, his hands held out from his sides to show he was unarmed. He was in his 60s and small but stocky. He looked like a man who had known hard physical labor in his time and probably enjoyed most of it. His hair was entirely white, and cut in a military flat top, while the face beneath was ruddy and lined, weathered by decades of exposure to summer sun and cold winters. Parker recognized him even before he introduced himself.
Mr. Parker, my name is Bobby Stonehurst.
I know who you are, said Parker.
Bobby Stonehurst, or Bobby Ocean, sire to Billy, the country's northernmost Confederate. Silently, Parker cursed Louis and his inability to turn the other cheek. But his anger was only momentary. Parker wasn't a black man forced to deal with the prejudices of others on a daily basis. Neither was he himself any particular model of restraint.
I apologize for entering your property without invitation or prior arrangement, said Stonehurst. It was a spur-of-the-moment decision. I was hoping you might grant me the courtesy of a short conversation.
About what, Mr. Stonehurst?
Nobody calls me Mr. Stonehurst. It's Bobby, or sometimes Bobby Ocean. That particular nomenclature appears to have stuck. Doesn't bother me.
Why don't we keep it formal? Aside from the issue of the truck, Parker knew enough about Bobby Ocean to want to hold him at one remove. Bobby Ocean's businesses generally employed only white men and women, but were not above contracting the messiest and most unpleasant of their service tasks to companies known to exploit immigrant workers, thereby outsourcing vindictiveness and the humiliation of the vulnerable. People of color gave his restaurants a wide berth. Service at the bar would be slow and neglectful. Unoccupied tables would be mysteriously unavailable to them, reserved for patrons who might never materialize. And a vague but undeniable aura of hostility would permeate their dining experience. But Bobby Ocean also contributed generously to select charities and supported initiatives to beautify and improve the city of Portland. He found favor with many, as long as they were Caucasian and comfortably off. People said he wasn't a bad guy and shouldn't be judged on his failings alone. But to Parker, Bobby Ocean's deficiencies could not be isolated from the totality of the man. They represented the core of his being and tainted all that he did. He was poisoned meat.
You know, I didn't take you for a church-going man, said Bobby Ocean.
Have you been following me, Mr. Stonehurst?
I saw you pull out earlier, when I first intended to speak with you, and we just happened to take the same road. I didn't wish to disturb you on your way to worship. I figured you'd be back here soon enough.
He sucked at some morsel caught between his teeth and swallowed it upon its release.
Catholic, huh?
That's right.
Bobby Ocean shrugged. He took in Parker, his vehicle, his home, and probably his Catholicism, too, and managed not to look obviously disappointed by any of them. But it was a close-run thing.
You live alone out here?
Yes.
It's a big place for one man.
You offering to help with the payments?
From what I hear, you're not hurting for money or influence. You mind if we sit down?
You know, I do.
Have I given you cause for hostility toward me? If so, I don't recall it.
Mr. Stonehurst, you have no reason to pay me a social visit, and if this relates to a business inquiry, my number is freely available. You can phone to make an appointment.
You don't keep an office. I find that unusual.
If I kept an office, I'd have to sit in it. There are more productive ways to spend my time. I meet clients at their homes or places of employment. Where that isn't possible, we find mutually agreeable venues. My house and the surrounding land, I like to consider private.
Is that because someone once tried to kill you here?
Two people tried to kill me here.
If you'll forgive me for saying so, I'm starting to see why.
Parker looked past Bobby Ocean to the marshes glittering in the morning sunlight, at the returning birds and the sea beyond. What had started out as a good, if contemplative, day was rapidly taking a turn for the worse.
Actually, I may not be inclined to forgive you, said Parker. Why are you here?
Are you aware that I approached Mr. Moxie Caston about an act of violence visited upon an item of my property?
Mr. Caston informed me. My understanding is that the property in question belonged to your son.
My son's name might have been on the papers, but that truck was paid for with my money. It was a gift to my boy. I choose to take personally what was done to it.
If what I hear is true, your son elected to decorate that truck with symbols of the Confederacy. Last time I checked, the Mason-Dixon line was still about 700 miles south of here.
And last time I looked, the First Amendment continued to guarantee freedom of expression.
You might take the view that whoever blew up your son's truck was exercising a similar right.
Don't be facetious, Mr. Parker. It ill becomes an intelligent man. I approached Mr. Caston about the incident because I believed the Portland PD was disinclined to give it the attention it deserved.
And Mr. Caston declined to involve himself in your affairs. Just as I will, if that's where this conversation is going.
Bobby Ocean ground his heel in the dirt of Parker's yard, like a bull preparing to charge. He even dropped his head. But when he looked up again, he was grinning. It was the response of a man who believes his opponent has made an error, one that he now fully intends to exploit.
I didn't expect Mr. Caston to oblige me. Mr. Caston is a Semite. In my experience, they are primarily a self-interested people. Since that hardly makes them unique among the races, their cupidity arouses no particular animosity in me, nor does it occasion surprise. But I do believe it runs deeper in them than in others, and such differences in racial character should be acknowledged.
Mr. Stonehurst, said Parker, I really would like you to remove yourself from my vicinity. But Bobby Ocean showed no signs of departing.
I think that first you ought to listen to what I have to say. I'll be gone from your presence soon enough, and then, if the Lord smiles on both of us, we won't have reason to talk again. I went to Mr. Caston, forearmed with suspicions about the identity of those responsible for this act of violence, and his attitude confirmed them. I've learned a lot about you, Mr. Parker. I'm told you consort with Negroes, homosexuals, and similar individuals of low moral character. Your clients have included a homeless man. You got shot chasing after the killer of a whore. You believe yourself to be defending the meek against the powerful, but you're misguided, or guilty of deliberate self-delusion. You're a weak man, and therefore you resent men without similar weakness. You form allegiances with those most like you, and use them to fan the flames of your inadequacy. You fly flags of convenience to indulge your love of violence.
Bobby Ocean spoke without spleen or viciousness. He might just as easily have been commenting on the weather.
You know, my grandfather fought in the Second World War, said Parker.
Bobby Ocean tilted his head in puzzlement.
Were he still alive, said Bobby Ocean, I'd thank him for his service, but I believe he's long gone from this world.
He is. He's buried just up the road at Black Point Cemetery. I filled in his grave myself.
That's something to be proud of. I mean that in all sincerity.
Parker ignored him. He was unconcerned by Bobby Ocean's opinion of him, or what passed for sincerity in this man's world. He had the measure of him now.
He never spoke much about what he saw over in Europe, Parker continued. I do know that he served with the 99th Infantry and suffered a shrapnel injury to his left leg at the Battle of the Bulge. It was only after he died that I found out how hard the 99th fought. They were outnumbered 5-1, and for every casualty they suffered, they inflicted 18 on the Germans. But my grandfather wasn't the kind to boast about his use of a gun. What he did tell me was that he was one of the first men into Wereth, Belgium in February 1945. Do you know what he found there? I do not.
he found the bodies of 11 African-American GIs who'd been captured by the 1st SS Panzer Division. They were beaten and tortured before being killed. One of them was a medic who died while bandaging another man's wounds. The Germans left them where they fell.
I have to confess that the nature of your thought processes is confusing to me, Mr. Parker. I'm struggling to see the relevance of this.
The relevance, said Parker, is that the men my grandfather fought spoke of the weak just the way you do. The relevance is that they, like you, displayed only contempt for those who did not share their nature or their creed or the color of their skin. The relevance is that I can tell where your son gets his ignorance.
Bobby Ocean inhaled deeply. The grin was long gone.
You and a Negro were seen drinking together within sight of my son's truck on the night it was destroyed, he said. I believe that you and he were responsible for what occurred. You're a blind man, Mr. Parker. You live by the sea, but you can't spot the changing of the tides. The time of your kind is passing, and a new order of men will take your place. Go tell that to your Negroes and your queers.
He turned away, got in his truck, and backed slowly down Parker's drive before heading west. Parker watched the road until the truck disappeared and wondered just how much worse his day might have been had he not gone to church.
Chapter 30. On reflection, Parker decided that it might be counterproductive, even unwise, to head out to the burial site without some form of permission to enter. He contacted Gordon Walsh, who didn't sound overjoyed to hear from him again, but didn't sound surprised either. Walsh agreed to make some calls, and Parker drove toward Piscataquis underneath clear blue skies, accompanied by Here and Now on Maine Public Radio. As he grew older, he preferred to listen to sensible conversation while he drove. Music he could choose for himself, or have selected for him by one of the half-dozen Sirius channels he favored. But he always learned something from exposure to NPR. Perhaps it was just a function of realizing as the years went by how little he really knew about very much at all. Parker tried to exorcise Bobby Ocean from his mind, but the man's voice, appearance, and bigotry persisted in intruding. Perhaps in part because Bobby Ocean, odious though he was, had a legitimate grievance, and the burning of his son's truck would serve only to harden him in his hatreds. As for Billy, he and Parker had never enjoyed any dealings. But Parker knew enough about him to be grateful for this. The condition of the road deteriorated as he neared Piscataquis County, and he bounced most of the way from Dexter to Dover Foxcroft, the blacktop pitted and broken, before continuing on toward Borstone Mountain. It wasn't difficult to spot the turnoff for the burial site. A couple of news vans were parked by the side of the road, along with a pair of Piscataquis County Sheriff's Office cruisers and one MSP cruiser, which was already pulling away as Parker arrived. Troop E out of Bangor worked Piscataquis and Penobscot counties. Fewer than 30 officers for a total area of almost 8,000 square miles, including the 100-plus miles of interstate between Newport and Sherman. Much of that land fell under the jurisdiction of local law enforcement, but when it came to serious crime, the state police held the bag. The news crews were kicking their heels. If no infant body emerged soon, the stations would reassign their resources to other stories. A reporter named Nina Aird, whom Parker knew as a face around town as well as on TV, was smoking a cigarette and flicking idly through her phone as he pulled up. Parker caught Aird glance casually at him once before looking more closely a second time while simultaneously signaling to her cameraman to get some footage, fast. The camera was already fixed on Parker by the time he gave his name to the first of the sheriff's deputies, and he knew the reporters would be waiting for him when he reappeared. Unless something more newsworthy transpired between now and deadline, his face would be on the evening news. The deputy waved Parker through, and he continued driving up a rutted dirt road so narrow that the branches of the evergreens at either side met above his head. About a quarter of a mile along, he saw another much larger conglomeration of cars and trucks, a mix of police, the main warden service, and civilian vehicles. Parker had already begun making notes of individuals with whom he might need to talk while he was up here. One of them was Ken Hubble, the local physician in Dover Foxcroft who served as ME for the immediate area on a voluntary basis. Hubble would have been among the first to visit the scene, and Parker thought it might be useful to get his impression of what had been uncovered, in addition to whatever could be gleaned from the police and wardens. For the present, though, it was the latter on whom he would have to concentrate. A dead body found in remote woodland generated a lot of activity, especially when there was the possibility of another set of remains buried somewhere nearby. While a Piscataquis County deputy had responded to the initial call about human remains, the Attorney General's office maintained a protocol for homicides and suspicious deaths, so the Piscataquis County Sheriff's Office had done the prudent thing and informed the Maine State Police of the discovery, followed by the Warden Service. Ken Hubble had quickly arrived on behalf of the ME, and so the accretion of personnel had begun. The MSP now had a dozen-strong evidence response team working the scene, alongside troopers, sheriff's deputies, staff from the ME's office, and the anthropological advisors and students from R&O. But anyone with any sense deferred to the wardens, who were the ones most familiar with the terrain, and who were responsible for organizing the search for the infant's body. That made for anything up to 70 people on the ground in total, as well as an assortment of cadaver dogs that Parker could already hear barking in the woods as he pulled up. A state police sergeant approached him. The badge on his uniform read Allen, which Parker recalled as being one of the 10 most common names in Maine. Apparently Smith was the most prevalent, although that was probably true of most of the other 49 states in the Union as well. Parker got out of the car, and he and Allen shook hands. Allen had responsibility for all those entering and leaving the scene, and it was easy to see why. He was about Parker's age, but had 50 pounds on him and a foot in height. It was hard to picture the trooper fitting easily into a car that wasn't specially built.
"I hear you want to view the scene," said Allen. "If it's okay with you. Detective Walsh gave the all clear, although he said that if you were to fall down a deep hole, none of us should be in any hurry to rescue you." "That Walsh, what a joker." "I'll be sure to watch where I step," said Parker. "Anything else I should be aware of?" "It's muddy as all hell in there, but at least you're wearing good boots. Other than that, it's the usual. Stay inside the marked paths and don't pick up a drop anything. I'd appreciate it if we could hold off for a few minutes, though. Just until you meet Gilmore." Lieutenant John Gilmore was the search coordinator for the Maine Warden Service. He was as highly regarded as they came. "Don't want to cross the wardens," said Parker. "Sure don't. Gilmore's dispatching search groups right now, but he's expecting you. We have coffee if you want it."
Parker accepted the offer. It was noticeably colder out here, and ice was more persistent and prevalent than on the coast. He went back to his car, found a pair of gloves on the floor behind the passenger seat, and slipped them on. Allen retrieved a thermos from his own vehicle and poured two paper cups of black coffee. They talked about nothing much until Gilmore appeared from the woods, trailed by a couple of civilians carrying GPS devices. He was another big man, although rangier than Allen. He said something to the civilians that sent them on their way before heading over to where Parker and Allen were waiting. Standing between the two men made Parker feel like an adopted child, his awkwardness lessened only slightly by Allen wandering off to make some calls.
"I know the face," said Gilmore, "and the reputation."
"Likewise."
"You here to stir up trouble?"
"Only if you think it might help."
"I suspect we have enough to be getting along with."
Gilmore poured himself coffee while Parker explained the reason for his presence, just in case anything had become lost in translation.
In return, Gilmore brought Parker up to date on the current status of the search. A cordon had been placed around the entire area after the initial discovery, following which the wardens had conducted a general examination of the landscape and eliminated those regions unsuited to the interment of a body, no matter how small, either for reasons of inaccessibility or unsuitability. The wardens couldn't guarantee where a body would be, but they could do the next best thing, which was to say where it wouldn't be. Meanwhile, Massar, the main association for search and rescue, had begun seeking volunteers to look for the child's remains. This whole process had taken a week to organize, but it meant that the search would be conducted in the most efficient manner possible. Now, teams of between 2 and 4 volunteers, each equipped with GPS and a dog, had commenced slow walks over carefully designated zones. As each zone was cleared, the GPS coordinates would be downloaded from the devices and the cleared areas marked on a map to ensure that nothing was missed, and time and energy were not wasted in the unnecessary repetition of tasks.
"If there's another body out there," said Gilmore, "we'll find it eventually."
"How long until you're sure?" asked Parker.
"Weather permitting, could be another week."
Alan rejoined the conversation, and Gilmore cleared up one or two further details for Parker before returning to the more immediate business of checking in with the search teams, as well as finding somewhere discreet to take a leak. And Parker followed Alan up the well-trodden trail to the grave. Chapter 31. Quayle had been following the news coverage of the body in the woods. Naturally, it interested him. But he had few contacts in this part of the world, and none in law enforcement. It was possible that these were the remains of Karis Lamb, but they might equally be those of another young female. Until the identity of the victim was established with certainty, Quayle would continue his hunt. Even if it were Karis in the ground, he would still need to find out who had put her there. Quayle knew that Karis Lamb had been given Mela Lombardi's name as a source of help and shelter in Maine. Since Karis had already shown herself willing to entrust her safety to Dobie and Backmire with no adverse outcome, Quayle considered it highly likely that she would have taken the next step and contacted Lombardi upon her arrival in the state. Lombardi lived on Orchard Road in Cape Elizabeth, not far from the big Pond Cove Elementary School on Scott Dyer Road, at which she had taught for many years. Orchard was tree-lined, and all of the homes were well-tended. Lombardi's was one of the smaller builds, little more than a cottage, Quayle thought, and not suitable as a family home. In fact, according to the plans that Quayle found online, it was just the kind of dwelling in which one might have expected to find a retired spinster schoolteacher. Single-story, with a double window at either side of the central front door, 2 bedrooms, one barely large enough to accommodate a twin bed, the other more substantial, a living room that flowed into the kitchen area, and 1 bathroom. It was set back slightly from the road and shaded by mature shrubs and hedges. It didn't have a garage, and the driveway was empty. This didn't trouble Quayle. He had no intention of approaching Lombardi by day. Orchard didn't have street lighting, so by night, the only illumination would come from porch lights and the interiors of the houses themselves. Getting to Lombardi without being seen would pose no particular difficulty, and once he and Moores were inside, they would have plenty of time to spend with her. They could find out what they needed to know, and Lombardi could be made to disappear. Quayle would let Moores take care of that. So, they knew where Lombardi lived, but they also knew what she looked like. The old busybody had been photographed for the local papers upon her retirement, and her name and image also cropped up regularly in bulletins from the Cape Elizabeth Historical Preservation Society, the Education Foundation, the Friends of the Thomas Memorial Library, and the League of Women Voters. Quayle wondered why Lombardi had never married or had children of her own. He thought he might ask her before she died. He hoped she wouldn't give him some sentimental claptrap about all her students being her children. He wasn't sure he could bear it.
"Where do you want to go?"
asked Moores. She was driving. She always drove because Quail had never learned and did not care to at this stage of his existence. He was especially grateful for her presence in this land of oversized vehicles, and it made him yearn once again for their business here to be done with so he could return to London, a city in which he could walk anywhere he needed to go, or slip into the comfort of a black cab, even join the masses on the underground, although Quail now rarely ventured far from the river. "Away from people," he said.
"Do you want to return to the hotel?"
They were staying as husband and wife in a motel by the main mall, under names that existed only on credit cards linked to temporary accounts and whatever identification they chose to present.
"No. Find me somewhere I can look at the sea."
Even as a creature of the city, Quail found comfort in the rhythms of oceans and the ebb and flow of tides. In this world, at least.
"You know," he said as the road unspooled behind them, "it is believed that salt calls to salt, and we respond to the sea because we come from it. But I don't think that's true."
"No?"
Moore's eyes did not leave the road, and she betrayed no real indication of interest. But then she so rarely did. Her body might have retained some superficial warmth, but at her core, Moore's was even colder than Quail. At best, she could just about rouse herself to a state of vague indifference.
"There is a greater ocean waiting in the next life, and into it all souls must flow."
"Even yours?"
Quail glanced at her to see if she was trying to be funny, but she was not. Still, there was no denying the presence of a certain hard wit, and perhaps a glimmer of inquisitiveness. It was unusual for her to hear Quail speak in this way.
"No, not mine. I'm referring to the commonality."
"Why not yours?"
"Because I have been promised oblivion."
"And what of me?"
"I think you'll enter the water. I think you'll face judgment."
Moore's was silent. A gull stood ahead of them, picking at roadkill. She slowed to give it time to ascend.
"Does that concern you?" Quail asked.
She turned to him, the car now almost at a halt. Her eyes were the peculiar gray of the scum found on certain ponds, the kind that even the thirstiest of animals prefer to skirt. Moore's had been marked for him as a teenager, and nurtured by a succession of carefully selected foster parents until she was ready to come to him in adulthood, when the welfare system no longer had any cause to pay cognizance to her. She was very good, perhaps the best of all those who had stood by his side over the years.
"I've told you before," she said. "You can choose to believe what you want. But I think there's nothing beyond this world. In the end, we'll all face oblivion."
"But what if you're wrong? And you are wrong."
"Then the next world can't be any worse than this one."
Quail knew all about her past, of what had been done to her before she came under his protection. Her loyalty to him was deep and unconditional, but not unrelated to what his influence had enabled her to inflict upon her abusers. Quail had regarded it as part of her conditioning, and Moore's was intelligent enough to recognize that by indulging her desire for revenge, she had made herself Quail's creature. But for her, it was a price worth paying. Whatever torment she had suffered as a child, she returned tenfold on her tormentors, and all thanks to Quail. He had brought her a kind of peace.
"You're mistaken about this world, just as you are about the next,"
Quail wanted to tell her, although he kept his counsel. Who was he to argue degrees of suffering with one who had already been through her own hell?
"And you are damned."
Chapter 32.
The fallen tree responsible for exposing the gravesite was gone. It had not been possible to bring a crane into woodland that might conceal another body for fear of causing a further collapse, or the destruction of any evidence that might remain under the topsoil, even after all this time. Instead, the tree was cut into pieces with chainsaws and hauled away, leaving only the wound on the ground caused by its upheaval, now protected by a tarp that hid it entirely from view. This was peatland, with a degree of tree cover over nutrient-poor soil. Parker had spent his youth exploring such places with his grandfather, seeking out palm warblers and yellowthroats, and the larvae of elfin butterflies among the spruces. But the ground coverage here was pitted and uneven, and marked by patches of exposed earth. It was an alopecic landscape. Parker placed a pair of blue polyethylene covers on his boots before stepping off the main trail and following Alan to the canopy over the grave. Alan unhooked the rope securing the main flap and pulled it aside so Parker could view the interior.
"I'd prefer it if you didn't step in," said Alan. "We've taken photos and video and searched all around, but, you know..."
Parker understood. For now, the scene was still active. Any kind of contamination had to be kept to a minimum, and Alan was already doing him a favor by being so cooperative. In any case, Parker didn't need to proceed. He could see all he needed from where he stood. The collapse of the tree had left a massive circular gouge, since widened in the course of the search for further remains. The interior smelled of dampness and dirt, and a faint mustiness that might just have been stale air trapped by the canopy, but was probably something more mortal. Just slightly off-center was the grave, the position of the body unmarked by tape or rods, since forensic mapping was now done electronically, using the head and groin as markers. The hole was smaller than Parker had anticipated. The restricted volume of the space occupied by her for so long seemed to accentuate the poignancy of her passing, as though in death she had huddled until such time as she might be discovered. Parker squatted and clasped his hands between his legs, almost like one in prayer. Alan didn't disturb him by speaking, but stood back in silence. Eventually, Parker said, "I was just thinking how small she was."
"She was found with her legs folded up to a chest. Less of a hole to dig. But even allowing for that, she was still just a little thing."
Parker stepped away from the canopy and waited for Alan to reseal it.
"Are you the same Alan who faced down Gillick and Audette outside Holton back in, what was it, 98?
Ryan Gillick and Bertrand Audette were respectively a serial rapist and a mid-ranking meth dealer who escaped from custody when they were transferred to Maine General following a gas leak at the old state prison in Thomaston. They headed for the Canadian border, armed with a pair of pistols picked up from an ex-girlfriend of Gillick's, presumably one of those he hadn't raped. At Holton, just a few miles south of the border, Gillick and Audette rear-ended a truck, an incident that attracted the attention of a passing state trooper from the Holton barracks. Audette panicked, and shots were fired. Gillick ended up dead, and Audette was languishing in the new state prison at Warren.
99, Alan corrected. "Yeah, that was me. Sounded more dramatic on the news than it was. I couldn't recall much about it when the AG's people came for my report. I just remembered being scared."
The Attorney General retained exclusive jurisdiction for the investigation of police use of deadly force. It wasn't a pleasant experience for any officer, although in more than 100 reviews of deadly force shootings conducted over almost 30 years, the AG's office had yet to recommend that criminal charges be filed against any officer in the state of Maine.
"I heard you took a bullet," said Parker. "No. Took a piece of masonry from a ricochet. Hit me in the small of the back. Still hurts if I sit for too long."
"The body does take such intrusions amiss."
Figured you'd know. More than I care to.
Together they walked back to the trail, and Alan showed Parker the Star of David hacked into the gray-brown bark of a black spruce on the other side. It was an older tree, approaching 50 feet in height, its branches short and upturned at the ends. Beneath the star was another indentation, but less clear. It looked as though someone might have begun carving an inscription before obliterating the marks.
"And you're sure this was made at the same time that the body was buried?" said Parker. "Only God can be that certain, but close enough, according to the forestry people."
"What about the tree that fell?"
"Probably of similar age to this one. Most of this thicket is black or red spruce with some larch. It dates back to the early 70s.
Furrows appeared in Alan's massive brow. It was like watching one of the faces on Mount Rushmore frown.
"What?" said Parker. "It's easier to show than explain. Just odd, that's all. I'll point it out to you when we go through the data."
Parker watched one of the searchers rise from a kneeling position and stretch, her hand against her lower back. Beside her, a chocolate Labrador yanked at its leash, eager for the game to continue.
"Do you have an opinion on all this?" "If anyone was asking," said Alan, "I'd tell them that if the child died at birth, it would probably have been buried with its mother. If someone was going to take the time to put her in the ground and carve that star as a grave marker, why not do the same for the baby?"
"And if the child died later?"
"Then I'm not sure I'd risk digging up one perfectly good grave just to add a small corpse. Wouldn't matter how sentimental I was feeling. I'd bury the child someplace else. You mind if I ask how you fit into all this? You looking for whoever laid her in the dirt?"
"I'm working for a lawyer. He's Jewish. He's concerned for the infant, living or dead. So I suppose I'm looking for the child."
"Mighty Christian of him. That's a joke, by the way. And if you're looking for the child, and it isn't buried somewhere here, then it seems to me that you are looking for whoever interred that girl."
Alan let his gaze drift from the dig to the trees and beyond, taking in fields, towns, cities unseen.
"And her child could be anywhere," he added.
But Parker said nothing. Like Alan, his mind was roving further than the dig.
"Why here?" he thought. "Why this place?"
"You want to look at the pictures now?" said Alan,
which brought Parker back. Back to the hole in the ground, and the smallness of the body it had once contained, of absence and loss delineated. He thought one word, but spoke its opposite.
"Yes," he said. "Let's do that."
Chapter 33. Daniel Weaver sat on his couch at home, watching TV and feeling sorry for himself. His mother was concerned about his two bottom teeth, which had grown wiggly, and the two top front teeth, which were also a little loose. But the dentist told Grandpa Owen that it wasn't unusual for kids of even 4 to start losing their primaries, and there was no reason to worry about Daniel. The dentist did find some decay in one of his molars, though, and asked if Daniel enjoyed an appetite for sugary sodas and sweet things. Grandpa Owen had to admit that Daniel would eat sugar straight from the bowl given half a chance, and the boy had yet to discover a soda he didn't like.
"He doesn't get it from me," Grandpa Owen told the dentist. "I don't dote on candy."
"What about his mother?"
"Well, she's like me. I know she takes sweetener in her coffee, but I believe that's as far as it goes with her."
Daniel was sitting in the dentist's chair while the conversation went back and forth, the words cavity and filling still ringing in his ears, because neither sounded good. The dentist smiled. She was younger than Daniel's mom and smelled of strawberries.
"It's okay," she said. "I'm not trying to blame anyone. It's just that we don't like seeing decay. Especially not in a boy Daniel's age. So we'll fill in this little cavity for now and keep an eye on him in case it's a sign of a larger problem. but I'm hopeful it's not. Meanwhile, let's ditch the sodas and juices and keep candy for a treat, okay?
This time her words were directed as much at Daniel as Grandpa Owen. Daniel nodded miserably. He really did like soda, and Baby Ruth's, and Reese's Peanut Butter